We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me for this episode, which is all about the 1948 Alfred Hitchcock film Rope. And I'm absolutely delighted to be talking about the film and really pleased to welcome a new guest onto the podcast. And his name is Robert Bellissimo. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's really nice to have you, and it's a nice way to kind of return the favor, I suppose. So just by way of an introduction for people, Robert, so you're a YouTube podcaster. I don't know if that's the best term, but you're the sort of the brains behind the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies channel. Is that right? So I don't know if you just want to tell us a bit about that. I know you've kind of rebranded recently, haven't you? But you were kind enough to invite me onto your channel not long ago. So it's nice to have you back.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed that classic Hollywood film talk last time. Yeah, it's hard to sort of put it into a box with YouTube. Like, are you a YouTuber? Are you a podcaster? All this is still so fairly new, especially video podcasting. So nowadays, I just say I'm a video podcaster. And of course, it's on YouTube. And it's going to be on another app shortly called MobFi TV. You'll be able to see the videos on that entertainment app, but it basically explores the many different ways in which stories are told on film. Hitchcock is a very specific type of director, you know, and then someone like Elaine May or John Cassavetes or Mike Leigh are very different, so obviously everyone has different value. And so we explore how those stories are told in a review, and I review it with different guests. And we pick, now what we're doing is we pick a double bill, and it can be the same, it can be looking at a certain director or looking at two films that have some kind of a connection. And we just dissect them, from the performances to the way in which the structure of the story, to the direction, to the cinematography, to whether, how emotional they are, if there's ambiguity, and stuff like that. So, and then on top of that, I have different guests that I interview, who are in the entertainment field, actors, screenwriters, and it's like a profile on their life and career, or we look at a very specific, project they had been in, and so on and so forth. So that's sort of the spine of the entire podcast.
So how have you found YouTube? Because I've heard various kind of horror stories over the years, you know, the comment sections are kind of like the Wild West and that kind of thing. But has your experience not been like that? Has your experience been pretty good with the platform?
Well, yeah, you know, it's been great, because what I love about YouTube is that they tell you what's working and what's not working. Where I believe on an audio podcast, you don't have that kind of information, right?
You mean from YouTube itself, or do you mean from...
Yeah, like they'll tell you, you know, when people click off of the videos, when they're really enjoying it. They tell you certain keywords that are more popular to search. So if I was typing in Hitchcock movies, they'll say, yes, this has a high search volume and is medium competition, and so on and so forth. So it gives you everything, which is so useful in terms of building the your channel and what people really want to see, but also finding a way to make it that what you want to do, within a middle ground of what works on the platform. So that I find really useful. And of course, you know, yes, I actually really enjoy dealing with comments, particularly angry comments, and we've had, you know, I mean, we even had someone once threatened to report our channel because admittedly something I mentioned that, you know, because certain films you can see for free, you know, on YouTube and stuff. And I think I had mentioned it once, and this one guy was really angry because he thought I, and he had a point, because, you know, you don't want to take away from the artists and Criterion. They're releasing these, there's a lot of work that goes into the prints but now, you know, I always hand it so diplomatically that the guy's like a friend of mine now, you know? So I never get mad. I always ask what the problem is. If they say, you know, if people think it's a, you know, we've been accused of a vanity project, we've been accused of, you know, just that the reviews are surface level. But so I always talk it out. I always try to look at those as lessons, as ways to improve, even if, I mean, there are some people who I've found who can be like, there's just a line that you can cross. And I've had it out with some people, but you know what? Largely people are really nice, and say really nice things. And I've had great feedback. I have great followers, people that I've gotten to know, that I've made connections with. So, I mean, largely it's been great, but I, like I said, you can learn from the, I guess what people call trolling. I'm not a big fan of that term because I think, yeah, there is people who just want to tear you up for no reason. But I think, you know, if they have an opinion, and hear them out, you can learn from it. So I love it. I personally love it.
That sounds good. That sounds like a healthy relationship to have with it. So maybe I've just heard the scare stories about YouTube. And
I'm sure there are. Yeah, I'm sure people have, you know, I know people get threatened even sometimes, you know, and it's, I totally get it. I haven't experienced that, but yeah, like I said, so far so good, and I really like it.
Okay, so like I said at the outset, we're going to talk about Hitchcock's film Rope, which I'm really looking forward to. It always seems to be a nice level of interest when we cover Hitchcock on the podcast. I've recorded about several of his films previously, so I normally just ask people, Robert, you know, their general thoughts on Alfred Hitchcock, you know, your general sense of him. Do you have particular favorites from his filmography? Yeah, what are your thoughts and feelings about Hitchcock?
Well, you know, it's funny because we had discussed, you know, how this talk was going to go today. And I kept thinking, yeah, why have I been so interested in Hitchcock? Because I love so many different kinds of movies, but I think generally speaking, I'm more interested in the less technical filmmakers. And Hitchcock is such a technical filmmaker, and he works on many levels. I mean, if you're not necessarily interested in learning about the craft of filmmaking, but you like movies, you know, that people will be entertained by his films. They'll go on emotional roller coasters and perhaps not necessarily know why they enjoy it so much. They'll say it's fun or it's entertaining, and it certainly is. He also works in this film buff sense of, because he's so technical, like a magician, in the sense of how does he make you so scared, or how does he also make you laugh, or how does he make you feel everything? And he knows the medium so well. I think he's one of the only few directors who made a number of silent films, made a 3D film, made comedies, made romances, made horror films, suspense films. He did everything, and he's a film school within himself. So his films are so technical. And because I also really admire craftsmanship, I've been really interested in, you know, there's been so much written about his use of editing, his use of montage, his use of music, his use of colors and cinematography, and how that emotionally affects the audience. So I'm just always fascinated. Of course, his use of suspense, which people talk about, his famous analogy, you know, if there's two people having a conversation and the bomb is underneath the table and the characters don't know, well, you know, tell the audience first. So then they'll be thinking, oh my God, get out. And the characters don't know it. If you don't tell the audience and they know as much as the characters know, they're just going to have that blast of emotion when the bomb goes off. But it's more emotional if you build the suspense. And he does that in so many of his films. I mean, you always often know more than the characters do. And that's why they play on you. And I love his sense of play on you emotionally. And I love his sense of contrast. Like, his murders always take place in places that we can always find ourselves in. you know, playgrounds or like strangers on a train at the end, you know, there's this fight, but meanwhile it's on a merry-go-round, you know. He did that from as far back as The Lodger in the mid 20s, where murders take place in, you know, a public setting, a politician speaking in the case of Frenzy, on a ski lodge. Like he always, and it's scarier, you know, when you think, God, I've been there, or I could be there. And he's so clever. I love his sense of dark humor, which I think really comes from his British upbringing. And this film, of course, Rope, is full of that, full of dark humor. So, you know, I think people find him very interesting on many different levels. And he also I'm more interested in his more psychological films. I mean, every time I see Vertigo, there's so much to discover about that relationship with Stewart and Kim Novak. And psychologically, particularly about Stewart's film, and I love Stewart's character, and I love what, you know, what he can do in one location. I mean, you know, like today we're talking about Rope. Amazing how much suspense and thrills and nail biting action is in one room, in one apartment. And he has that also in Lifeboat, which is a great film. Dial M for Murder, Rear Window. It's just he's like a magician, and I think people are always interested in those tricks of how does the magician do this. And of course, you know, people have learned so much from him and built on a number of things of his suspense films or his ways of telling stories. But yeah, I mean, my personal, as you asked, what are some of the films I like? Yeah, certainly, as I said, Vertigo. Wrong Man is another one that I'm probably more interested in his lesser known films. I think The Wrong Man is brilliant. And it's a totally true story, and it's more of a documentary feel, but at the same time, he has his use of the medium where he's using things from as far back as the silent period to do something with the shots so that the audience feels what the character is feeling. Like when Henry Fonda's in the prison and and the camera starts to go around and round, and you know, you're feeling dizzy, and his use of POV, of course, in so many of his films, so you're seeing through the eyes of the character, is so frightening and effective. Lifeboat, I only saw Lifeboat last year because on our podcast we did a Hitchcock talk with another video podcaster, and someone suggested we talk about Lifeboat, and I thought Lifeboat was brilliant. But certainly his more obvious, you know, ones I love as well. I mean, I love Psycho. I just think everything from the MacGuffin, his use of MacGuffin in that, and of course the shower scene, and his use of metaphors, and his use of, you know, tormented, you know, psychological characters. But those are probably some of my favorite. I love Dial M for Murder. Rope, too. I mean, like I said, his one location films are some of his best, in my opinion.
That's interesting. I wasn't sure what you were going to say about Rope. For me, I never used to think this way, but I now think that Rope is one of his finest films.
I think so, too.
When I first saw this film, I was a teenager. I was probably about 14 or something like that. I think at that point, the opinion I had, I've seen in other places too, where I've seen the film described as like an intriguing failure, that kind of thing. And I, at that time, I thought that the way the film was made was interesting, but it was a bit gimmicky. That's what I felt. And I went a long time then without rewatching the film until last year, I think. I never had the film on DVD or anything, but last year I hadn't rewatched it in so long. And I was surprised and pleased to find it a much richer viewing experience than I remembered it being back in the day. So I think we'll go through and talk about some of the reasons why. But so you agree, you think it's a really strong Hitchcock film that's right up there. Is that it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it certainly is. I mean, it plays on so many levels. I mean, it's really funny on the one hand, because of how the contrast between the two main characters who commit the murder. Just, you know, one guy is so cocky, so confident. He's having a blast in order to, you know, let's kill the guy, put him in this table, and then have a party. You know, there's something funny about that, you know, and he's got his father there. He's got his girlfriend there. He's got his girl, the girlfriend of the guy who they killed's ex-boyfriend there. You know, it's like, it's so sadistic and twisted, but like I said, it's certainly funny. And you think there's no way you're going to get away with it. But the reality is they could have got away with it, but it's, you know, you got the one guy so cocky that he says one word too many, which makes Jimmy Stewart suspicious. And then you have Farley Granger's character who was so scared and he's, you know, he's reacting so strongly to any of the subtle things that what's the other character's name? I should have looked that up.
So we have John Dahl as Brandon, don't we?
Brandon.
And we have Farley Granger as Philip. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so Brandon, you know, certainly he's so cocky that he thinks he can get away with everything. And, you know, he's talking, he's got the rope, you know, he's flipping the rope around. Yeah. And he even says, you know, those are the funny bits where he says to the woman there, to the other guy, the ex boyfriend who's there. Well, I think you'll have a good chance with her, you know? Because of course the guy's dead in the drawer. So the fact that he has all of these things, everyone is so distinctive, everyone is so specific and brings a different element to push the story forward. It's just so unique. And like I said, it's in one setting. And I just love the connection and the ways in which the Brandon and Philip are interact, which ultimately leads to their downfall. So
yeah,
it's quite remarkable.
I think it is a remarkable film. I agree. Yeah, and we'll come back to the characters because there's actually a lot of interesting things to discuss about Brandon, Philip, and Rupert in particular. I think let's start with the technical side of things here because I think that's often what, you know, how rope is discussed.
Yeah.
So the film consists of, I believe, 11 shots in total, 10 of them inside the apartment. Of course, there's the first shot where the credits play, where you're outside. As you said, deliberately restricted locations is a Hitchcock trait.
Mm.
It's often described as a film with full of 10-minute takes. It's not actually true because only three of the shots are actually over 9 minutes long. The shortest shot is only 3 minutes long. They actually vary more than people think.
Mm.
But I think this divides opinions somewhat. And Hitchcock himself has said different things about it. Now, in his famous interview with Francois Truffaut, which I'm sure long-term listeners will be fed up with me quoting from because I always bring it up.
Yeah.
But Hitchcock says to Truffaut, "I undertook rope as a stunt. That's right. The only way I can describe it. I really don't know how I came to indulge in it." He also describes it as a crazy idea and nonsensical. Now, I believe with Hitchcock, he sometimes said different things to different interviewers. He may have said differently at different points in time,
right. You know,
that kind of thing. But what are your thoughts on that, on the use of long shots? Do you think it's a stunt?
I don't think it was. I think he wasn't giving it enough credit to say it was purely a stunt. And of course, in that same interview, as you know, Truffaut, even said that to him,
yeah.
To him, you know, you're not giving it enough credit. And of course, he even said, well, I went against everything that I believe in, which is cutting, which is editing. But, you know, this was a play. It was so I think the fact that he didn't cut at all really made me as the audience, you know, because he's not telling you where to look. And I always find that interesting because then I can look where I want to look, and then which is what interests me more. And then with every single viewing, I'll see more and more where my attention goes, which that's the kind of, not that I necessarily love films that are all one take, but I'm always interested in those directors who don't necessarily tell me exactly how to feel. And that's why I think this is so interesting, because like just in my last viewing, I certainly saw more with Philip than I had seen in previous viewings, because I was just gravitated more towards that. So I don't think it was, I think he did it because perhaps as a way to experiment, but also because he knew it was a hit play. And he thought, why don't we try to bring the element of theater in it? I mean, that's what I imagine, but I think it enriched it in my opinion, for, as I said, he's not telling you where to look, how to feel, like he does in his other movies.
Although he kind of is, isn't he? Because you follow characters out into the hall and that kind of thing. It's not like you just put the camera down.
He certainly is to an extent, but it's a little more secondary as opposed to his other films where it was, you know, all okay, you're scared here. This is sad. This is happy. This is romantic. This one's a little more in the middle, I'd say.
Yeah, I think at this time, he definitely saw long shots as an alternative to his use of montage, because he even applied the same ideas to his next film, Under Capricorn.
That's right.
Not quite as rigidly, but there are some very long shots in Under Capricorn. And I know Ingrid Bergman at the time was kind of, it's a very challenging thing for actors, you know, when the, you know,
oh, yeah.
you're walking around, the set's being moved, the walls are being rolled back, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's like doing a play, but even harder, because then you have so much technical elements around you to perform under.
Yeah. Well, I believe it was very complex here, because you had, like I say, walls being rolled around, moving furniture. They made some kind of special floor.
Yeah.
Obviously, that backdrop with the lighting. So, yeah, it made things quite difficult for the actors is what I heard. James Stewart was quoted as saying, the only thing that's been rehearsed around here is the camera. He thought it was all kind of secondary to the technical side of things. Arthur Lorenz, who wrote the screenplay, he had an issue with the look of the film in some ways, because he said the kind of hidden cuts bothered him. So, you know, every so often the camera will focus on somebody's back or something.
Right, because they had to cut, yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes you get a more traditional, undisguised cut. Somebody will glance to the side and you'll cut to something.
Yeah.
Apparently that's where the projection reels needed to be changed in the cinemas.
Right.
So picking up on like the back of somebody's jacket or whatever would have been very difficult for projectionists. So they couldn't have been relied on to get that right all the time, is the explanation I've heard. Do you think there's any truth to that suggestion that the sort of hidden edits are an issue here? Do you find them distracting at all?
I didn't find it. You know what? I didn't find it distracting at all. I think once you dissect it, you can spot them, of course. But they're not so jarring. I think the only obvious, there is one cut that is an obvious cut, not in a distracting way, in a traditional way, where, you know, he's Brendan is suddenly getting really upset about Philip talking about the Philip is Farley Granger. I don't know why I can't get that straight. Philip,
you mean the moment with the glass, is it? No,
yeah, who breaks the glass in his hand.
Yeah.
You know, he's getting so upset about this strangling chickens and how the other guy's talking about that, and that's the only time you then see it cut to Jimmy Stewart and it hangs on him and he's thinking, why are you getting so worked up? But no, I didn't find it distracting at all. I think, you know, it's quite seamless. It just goes into a jacket or that character crosses the frame and then it zooms out. I didn't find it distracting at all. I mean, have you read that people have found it distracting?
Yeah. So like I said, the screenplay writer has said that.
Okay.
I don't think it happens at moments where it's a big problem though. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't happen at really kind of attention grabbing moments. So I don't find it a problem. I'm not sure if I used to, I can't really remember, but he could have done the whole film, I suppose, without doing that. Cause you have half of the cuts or thereabouts.
Yeah.
A more standard. So I suppose he could have found another way to do it, but that's what it is.
Yeah, no, I always thought it was fine. I think if you were watching this on a first viewing and knew nothing about it, I don't think anyone would be like, oh, there's a hidden cut. You know, I think it's quite seamless from my view.
I think these days you probably have a bit of computer generated wizardry to make it even more
kind of
seamless, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And now a lot of people have done that, you know, Birdman.
Birdman.
Is it 1917 or 1914 with
17, yeah.
Sam Mendes. It's, you know, hasn't been done often, but surely then it had never been done.
Yeah. I think there's a film, Russian Ark, isn't there, which is the entire film plays out without a cut from the early 2000s, which kind of took it to that next level.
Yeah.
So, James Stewart was one of the people who admired kind of Hitchcock's technical efforts, but he also said he didn't feel the film really worked, which is interesting. But then, of course, he comes back to work with him several other times.
Yeah.
And it's Hitchcock's first color film. So
that's right.
Yeah. And there were some issues there, like that you know, obviously you get the changing of from early evening to night during the course of the film. And they had to redo some stuff because that orange, you know, they had this orange sunset in the background, which they felt was, Hitchcock felt was too lurid and had to be redone. So I think you actually see two directors of photography credited on the film. I think one was kind of replaced is the implication.
Yeah, because I believe he didn't think it was a big deal. And Hitchcock was like, no, it is.
So they changed things up.
Yeah.
Just on in terms of numbers, I can tell you that skyline was lit with 8,000 incandescent bulbs, 200 neon signs.
Wow.
According to Hitchcock, 26,000 feet of wire carried 126,000 watts of electricity for that window illumination. So that sounds like a lot to me. I really like that slow change from early evening to night that we get during the film, because I think it's quite appropriate to what plays out on screen. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I really love that. And that's of course when it starts to get the story, of course, starts to get darker and darker, and particularly as Rupert comes back. And that's when everything is revealed. No, I love that. And again, it's quite seamless. It doesn't feel I mean, obviously the backdrop looks like a play. It's artificial and a backdrop. But I mean, in terms of the light, I thought that was beautifully done. And even there were, I imagine that was maybe like, you know, hotel marquees, like the lights were coming in like red and green and stuff. It looks gorgeous. I think it looks fantastic. And then of course, the use of sound when, you know, the ambulance, everything starts to go up as they sit and wait for the cops to show up. I love that. I think it's... his use of silence there is just, in terms of the characters not saying anything, was you know, really engaging, in my opinion.
And also the moment when Stuart opens the window and you sort of get that, you know, fresh air coming in, it stops feeling quite so oppressive.
Yeah.
I really like it for the same reason you say. Like you say, you go from this quite light, convivial atmosphere at the party, things get more uneasy, and it ends up in this quite tense, dark confrontation.
He also in the opening credits start like the and of course, as I said earlier, he'll make you think that you're gonna see something that is gonna be light. I mean, it's like, you know, you're on a sidewalk, it's this like, it feels like it's gonna be a romantic comedy, and then as soon as that camera starts to slowly go through the window, gonna be seeing a very different film. And he was always playing with the audience that way.
Because I think the first thing you see on the street is a woman pushing a pram or something, don't you?
Yeah.
Some people think Hitchcock cameos in that opening credit sequence. I don't think it's him who walks down the street. There's a man who looks a little bit like him, but it's not Hitchcock. Hitchcock's cameo in Rope is actually at the 55-minute mark. People are keeping score. He appears as kind of a neon outline, you know, the famous Hitchcock silhouette outside the window. So people need to go and look for that, I think.
Yeah, you know, I've read that, and I'm sure if I consciously tried to spot it, I could, but I never, it doesn't stand out like his other cameos do. I'll have to go and actually spot it, but it must be so subtle. If it's a silhouette, I imagine it's quite subtle.
Yeah, it's very easy to miss. I had to Google exactly where it was so I could say that I'd seen it.
Yeah.
You know, every time I see the film, I don't spot it, you know, consciously. So I think what's so great about Rope is you have this, what is this? Like a dawning realization, isn't it? From Rupert's character. Two things. A, that Brandon and Philip are murderers. And also B, what makes it even more effective, I think, is that he's kind of realizing that he's complicit because it's his kind of worldview that they've put into practice, isn't it?
So right.
If we're talking about the technique, I think it's what Hitchcock's done. He's found a really apt way to visualize that. So like I said, the color schemes like this, it kind of charts the changing mood. And I think the long shots are a very good way to connect sort of the theoretical discussion they have about murder and then the fact that murder's actually taken place. So do you know, remember that scene where Rupert's arrived at the party, he's talking about the right of superior beings and he's talking about like strangulation day and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Cutthroat week, all that kind of thing. And then the camera just kind of turns to the murder victim's father, doesn't it? And he seems quite uneasy. He's looking out the window. So you've got this kind of dinner party, you know, talking point. And then you've got the actual fact that, you know, somebody has died here. And I think doing that within the same shot is very clever. It makes it very insidious. You know what I mean? I mean, you could have done it. You could have cut from Rupert saying that to the father. But I think the camera moving to him is a nice, unsettling, quite chilling way to do it. Do you know what I mean? It works really well, I think. So that's what I think I was missing all those years ago when I saw Rope and I thought it was quite gimmicky, is I think there's a real purpose to it, you know?
Yeah, well, that, you know what, that's a good point. And that is probably one of the most chilling scenes, because suddenly at that moment, you really feel for the father, the fact that, you know, what the father's lost, which he's not aware of, because of what they're saying is so ignorant. And so, I mean, you never quite know if Jimmy Stewart is kidding or not, you know, and because he says it straight without, but then he has sort of these odd side jokes, like you said, strangulation weak. But then, of course, you know, Brendan is so convinced, and again, this is just that guy. He says too many words too many out of his ego and thinking he can get away with everything. But yeah, that certainly is where the black humor starts to go at that point. It starts to get more and more, you know, emotional and intense and you know, dark.
So let's talk a bit about Brendan and Philip, because I think that there's some interesting stuff going on there. Now, they're usually read in a certain way, I think, especially by contemporary audiences. And I think you've heard of this, because I think we spoke about it briefly off air. So what's your sort of basic take on the relationship between the two of them? How do you sort of see them?
Well, this is what's so fascinating about this film, is that I had heard over the years, people have said that it was coded that they were lovers. And when I always knew that, and then I didn't think of it at all when I reviewed it on my video podcast last year, and we mentioned it, and all we said was I didn't see it, other than perhaps the fact that they're going to go to Connecticut together. But then when I posted that on, actually there are some phenomenal Hitchcock Facebook groups, and as a way to engage people with the video, I would say, you know, over the years, people have said these two are lovers. What do you think? And it got so many comments, people agreeing, disagreeing, arguing, fighting over it. And there was a lot of valid points. And someone had sent me a clip of looking at the opening scene. And there's some YouTube video where I think there's some narration over it, where that them killing the guy was coded to say that they were having sex. You know, the lights are off, the blinds are closed, and you hear that scream was meant to be like it's coded for a scream of an orgasm. And then it's you know, don't turn the lights off, you know. Yep. The cigarette, let's just sit here for a minute. And I was like, I don't know if that's a little far reaching. I mean, it's possible that they saw it that way, but someone on Facebook made me laugh and said, well, if that was meant to be an orgasm, that's one hell of an orgasm, you know, because it's a scream of pain. Right. So, you know, and, but other than that, yeah, you know, the Connecticut, the two guys live together, of course. Someone else said that at one point you could only see one bedroom, and I was trying to spot that, and I maybe I missed it, but I don't know if you saw that. Is there only one bedroom?
I think there's at least two bedrooms, because the housekeeper, Mrs. Wilson, directs Mrs. Atwater to go down the hall to the first bedroom. So if there's a first bedroom, okay, that implies there's a second bedroom.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's kind of ambiguous, because at other times they refer to the bedroom, which sounds a bit more like a singular thing.
Yeah, yeah. Know. But, you know, it's, yeah, exactly. And I think it's certainly valid if people see them as being lovers, even in the Hitchcock Truffaut book. I don't know which version you have, but under the notes, it says, oh, two homosexual lovers. And I know I had heard even at the time, the certain theaters, movie chains wouldn't screen it because they thought it was certainly that they were lovers. But I mean, it's valid. But even if they're not, I don't think it has anything to do with the story or why they killed him, from my point of view. But then if you look at Philip, he is doesn't seem like someone who would do this. You know, he's so scared from the beginning. I mean, which makes me wonder about this relationship, because I think, you know, all he says was that Brandon talked him into it. So, you know, friends talk people into it, peer pressure and stuff like that, but they're older, they live together. I can understand a lover convincing someone of something, you know, you do it for them, you do it for guilt, obligation, or so, you know, I think it's certainly valid, but I think it's really up to the audience as to whether they're gay or not. There are certainly hints and certainly suggestions, which makes it more interesting and sort of enriches it. But yeah, I mean, obviously this is also based on Leopold and Loeb story, as you know. I'm sure that these, you know, two young men who killed a kid strictly for the fun of it. I'm not sure if their motives were exactly as Brandon and Philip were. But yeah, I mean, you know, Brandon is clearly a psychopath. He's clearly gets off on danger. He clearly is doing this. He has no feelings for anyone. Everyone is for his own sick joke, particularly the young woman and the young man who were there, and everyone who's there. I mean, it's a sick joke to put this guy on a table while the father is in the room. He's treating it, as he says, an art form, and it's the murder is for the privilege of a few. So he is just something else. I mean, he obviously is mentally disturbed. But the only reason I can think of that Philip would go, because he does not seem that way at all from the way he's behaving. The only thing I can think of is some kind of loyalty to his friend, or that they are lovers. And he's, you know, you see that with relationships. You do things for the other person. You compromise, right? It's one hell of a compromise.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot. So there's a lot going on, I think. So they're often read as a gay couple. And like you say, if that is the intention, it had to be coded, because that wouldn't have been permissible at the time. And the thing is, if you code something, there's always the potential then for people to take it in different ways. I think it is relevant to the film, because I think what it almost implies is that you kind of have this connection between the desire to murder and being kind of closeted homosexual at that point in time.
Right,
so
right.
You can sort of see their desire to kill as some kind of compensation for the fact that they had to kind of sublimate their natural desires. So
yeah.
I think that gives the film a lot of its impetus. And I think Hitchcock does it in a fascinating way. I think that if the film was made now, I think a lot of people would say, well, this is reinforcing harmful stereotypes. You know, a lot of people would say Rope is kind of equating being gay with being deviant.
Yeah, like saying, well, you know, if he's gay, then that's going to turn him into a killer or something.
Yeah, which would be seen as, rightly be seen now as being unacceptable, I think.
Yeah.
The question, though, of whether they're lovers is more interesting than I realized, I think, because they could be homosexual but not be lovers. That's possible. So there's a great book on Hitchcock by a guy called Robin Wood, who's a British scholar. He wrote Hitchcock's Films Revisited, it's called. And Robin Wood was a gay man, and he talks about seeing Rope on release when he was 17. And he said it never occurred to him that the characters were gay.
Right.
But he was very kind of drawn to the character of Brandon. He identified with him strongly. And so he says, look, we can't be certain that they're lovers in the way we understand that term now.
Right.
They may be gay, they may live together. But at that time, homosexuality was so frowned upon, but a lot of people just didn't think that way. He says at that time it was literally, the quote is, it was at that time literally unthinkable. Now he's talking about England, you know, so there are different standards,
right?
And so
because it was illegal there at that time, right? Until 67, I believe,
till the 1960s,
exactly. Yeah.
So one of the interesting things, I think, is that, like he says, he was very drawn to Brandon in a way that he hadn't been drawn to other film characters. So you can sort of see it as maybe it's producing these harmful stereotypes at the same time as Hitchcock is able to identify with Brandon. Because it seems to me like that character, you know, the audience is likely to gravitate to Brandon quite early on, I think. Because Philip's very nervous.
Yeah.
But Brandon's a bit more amiable and a bit more amusing. And he is enjoying himself. And obviously, we know he's committed murder because that's the first thing we see. So we may want them to get caught, but I don't think we want them to get caught immediately, do we? We want them to have some fun with it. So there's kind of a duality there that maybe we're identifying with these murderers. Do you know what I mean?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Yeah, because I mean, it's like if you look at gangster films, like why are people so attracted to these guys who are, you know, doing things outside of the law and committing murder? I mean, you want them to get caught, but at the same time, I think we're attracted to people who do exactly what they want to do. You know, it's sort of a something sick. I think even within us that. Yeah. You know, as much as we perhaps want to tell someone off or cut someone out of our life, we don't do it because of the consequences. But someone like Brendan, he doesn't care about the consequence. I mean, he doesn't want to go to jail, but he doesn't have any empathy or compassion or feelings towards anyone else. But that's a good point. You know, it's an interesting point. I mean, I didn't dwell on it too much when I watched it again last night. To prepare for our talk today, but I did think, you know, because he tells you why he did it. Of course, this whole thing could be coded, as you said, because he has to repress himself, that repress his feeling, his sexual feelings. When he releases it, it's coming out in murder because he has to hold everything back, which I think is. I really wonder if that was the intent. I would suppose it's really up to the audience. It's certainly possible. I mean, usually for me, for my experience, is that when things are ambiguous, the director or the writer will suggest something. So then people can think, well, I think it's this, or I think it's that, or I think it's a combination of the two. But I understand, of course, they couldn't even suggest it then. They had to have the character say exactly why they did it. This thing about being superior, it's very much like out of the way Hitler thought. So, yeah, it's a tough one, isn't it? I don't really know how I feel. I can only really go based on what he says. But yeah, I mean, there certainly could be a combination of, well, I'm being forced to not be myself, so therefore it's coming out in violence, or really he really did believe he was better than everybody and this theory of superiority and stuff like that. It's a tough one.
It's an interesting one. I think on the making of documentary that's on the Blu-ray, Arthur Lorentz says that they never mentioned the word homosexuality when they were making the film. Hitchcock never used the word. Nobody at Warner's did.
Yeah.
But he says that he seemed to suggest that everybody kind of knew that's what the suggestion was.
Right.
The other thing I've seen pointed out is, so that, like you say, that suggestion that the murder and the aftermath of the murder, there's some kind of sexual suggestions there with like the heavy breathing and so on. But then later you have Brandon holding the champagne bottle, but he's not able to uncork it. So the idea is that's some kind of repression or kind of a suggestion of impotence.
Ah, right.
Philip is then able to pop it, isn't it? It's when he says the line, "Nobody except us, Brandon," and it pops.
Oh God. You know, I didn't even pick up on that.
That's what I like about Hitchcock films. There's always these things you can go back and say, well, what does this mean?
It enriches the experience. Yeah. He always has those little details like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the idea with that champagne cork being that they can only get some form of release through their shared experience, which here is murder. Brandon also talks about feeling this tremendous exhilaration when the body went limp. And again, you can sort of say, well, there's some sexual connotations there.
And of course, the stroking chickens, you know.
I didn't even think of that one. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. And of course, if Brendan is talking openly about Philip stroking chickens, it's as if he's telling everyone he's gay. And that's why Philip is getting so, hey, don't tell anyone or something along those lines. That was another one someone pointed out to me. But again, they're so well, if that was the intent, they're so well coded that you got to really lean in to see it. But then when you do lean in or other people point it out, I'm like, oh yeah, you know what? That is pretty obvious, isn't it? You know?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, it is clever. And I think that's one of the fascinating things about Hitchcock is he has that ability, like we've kind of already alluded to, but to kind of implicate the audience by making us aware that we're kind of impure, you know. So in Rear Window is a great example where we share the urge to look across the yard that James Stewart's character has.
That's right.
And I think a big part of that, and you get it a lot in Rope, is that idea that there's this really thin line between like order and chaos. So here you've got this really fascinating collision, haven't you? Because you've got what's meant to be quite a civilized social gathering. And of course, a murder has taken place and the body is in the trunk, in the chest, you know. So I think some of these associations with homosexuality that we're talking about, I think they kind of contribute to that tension in kind of a productive way. But at the same time, like I said, I think it does create some maybe associations or stereotypes that are a bit unfortunate as well.
No, definitely. And you know, I know that even recently TCM have, I'm sure you saw, they've been looking at old classics at, you know, the problems in them. And they were pointing that out in something like The Children's Hour, you know, which is, you know, well, if someone finds out you're gay, then that person has to die. Which, you know, there are valid points of, yeah, reinforcing those kind of stereotypes. And sure, I mean, you see that here. If people think this is coded for homosexuality, yeah, there are problematic stereotypes that go along with that.
Yeah, well, like I say, in that Robin Wood Hitchcock book, he says that actually, like he talks about the stereotyping, and he also says, well, you can see it as very accurate because at that time, yeah, society was conditioning gay men to hate themselves.
Exactly.
You know? And by extension, other gay men. So you see Brandon and Philip are often at odds with each other in this film, which is interesting.
Yeah. And you see that in Children's Hour as well. It's the same thing.
So he's saying it's kind of reflecting as well as kind of reproducing.
That's how I always saw it as well. Yeah. In regards to just this theme in something like, as I mentioned, Children's Hour, I always saw it as it's accurate of, you know, if it came out or suspected that because of the way society felt about it, that then they would hate themselves or they would kill themselves because they would feel that they had to. I don't think it's as simple as saying, well, the gay character has to die. That's just the way it has to be. It's more of, this is the problem, not with you, but with the society around you. That's what has to change. You know, that's what, and of course, obviously we've come a long way since.
By the way, in the play from 1929 that the film is based on, the murder isn't shown apparently. Now the writer here, Arthur Laurent, says that Hitchcock, I think the phrase he uses is crossed him up, kind of by showing the murder. So I think he means kind of, I don't know, Seldom a Kipper. He feels basically that it removed a lot of the tension by showing the murder at the outset. I'm not sure if I agree with that, because like the comparison you said earlier with the bomb under the table, that's quite a good example of it, isn't it? We know, yes, that body's there the whole time.
Yes. Yeah. I read that, and I suppose perhaps the writer wanted it to play maybe a little more like a whodunit, or did anything happen? Like, did these guys do anything and then reveal it at the end? But I think, you know, there's a reason why Hitchcock is the master of suspense. And I think having the audience know more than all those characters did, it's a very different emotional experience. For all the things that we've talked about, feeling sorry for the father, you wouldn't feel sorry for the father if you didn't know they had done it. If you knew as much as the father, then it would have turned into a, did they do it or did they not? And then, oh, they did at the end. So I think I have to go with the way Hitchcock did it. I think it was much, much better to have shown the murder, to have it as a suspense film.
Because then we get moments, don't we, like when Mrs. Wilson is clearing up, you know, and she's almost about to open the lid.
That's a funny scene too. And I love that the camera's on her the whole time and you hear them talking. Where could he be? You're like, oh my God, no one's watching her, and she's just almost opens it. I love that. That's again, brilliant on his, and again, plays into that, you know, sadistic sense of humor.
So just to pick up on Brandon again, so I think people have said he's in the lineage of other Hitchcock characters. People have compared him to maybe Uncle Charlie in Shadow of a Doubt, Bruno in Strangers on the Train. The comparison being that, well, they're quite appealing in some ways. They have quite clever perspectives, but ultimately it's based on something very appalling, which we know here.
Right.
Like I say, in some ways we gravitate towards Brandon, even though we know he's a diabolical murderer.
Yes.
I think the fact he can kind of control things is quite significant, isn't it? Because he's kind of leading the way, isn't he? He decides to change the party around. He decides to get the table changed, to restage it. And he's got this idea that it's like a work of art, you know, and we get that that idea recurring through the film. So he's putting on a show for the audience at the party and the audience watching the film. And then, of course, we get a very interesting transference, don't we? Because as the film proceeds, we transfer from Brandon to Rupert, don't we? And that's kind of a Hitchcock trademark, I think, where you transfer your identification from one character to another, you know?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, what that last act, that last 18 minutes or so of the film, you're really with Rupert at that point. Then you go away from Brandon and Philip.
Yeah, because he enters quite late in the day, doesn't he, Stuart? I was surprised on rewatch how late it is. It's well over a third of the way into the film.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite striking how long it takes.
Yeah.
But of course, he's the film, you know, James Stewart is the film's biggest star.
Right.
And then in the narrative, he starts to gradually work out something's wrong and he puts together what's happening. And then in the later stages, towards the end of the film, you get that moment where he kind of recreates the murder. He's talking about it and the camera's kind of tracing back over David's, you know, it must have been his progress through the apartment, you know. So you sort of go from Brandon is kind of running the show at the beginning of the film. By the end of it, it's Rupert who's in control, isn't he? And that's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Because then, you know, he knew those guys so well. And he was able to put himself in their shoes. I mean, at that point, he had enough clues. And he also, of course, found the hat.
Oh, that's a good moment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, really. So good. He knew that they definitely did something. So, you know, you got the rope. And then he's also saw that Brandon was adamant about not opening the table. I mean, he was able to just put himself there like a detective, you know. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. And again, according to the writer, Arthur Lorenz, well, actually, so the story about the writing is that Hume Cronyn was originally invited by Hitchcock to work on the screenplay.
Yes.
I think he just wrote a treatment. And then Arthur Lorenz was brought in, and apparently he got on well with Hitchcock, and he talks a bit about how Hitchcock used to ply him with wine when they were supposed to be working and that kind of thing. But what Lorenz says is that James Stewart's character was supposed to be implicitly gay.
Right.
And was supposed to have had a relationship with one of the murderers. So I think possibly Brandon, but I don't think it's really clear in the film. But what he says is that none of that comes across because James Stewart's image is very different.
Yeah.
And Lorenz thought the film was kind of out of focus because of that. So with Rupert, we get the sense that he's unmarried, don't we? Because he says he might marry, he jokes that he may marry Mrs. Wilson. I don't think he wears a wedding ring. There are some comments about the intense bond he once had with Brandon, I think when he was tutoring him. I don't know. In those discussions you were talking about earlier where you discussed the film before and a lot of people talked about this, were people really talking about Stewart's character as possibly being gay, or are people not really seeing it in that way? What's your sense?
People felt that the fact that Stewart was cast because he's such a all-American straight man, there's nothing that in his behavior that could possibly even suggest that. So it was hard to even think about that purely because it's Stewart. Whereas the other two men, they have more of a feminine quality, right? So I think there was no way to even think about that other than to say he was miscast, if that was the intent. I mean, some people thought if Cary Grant had done it, then that would have...
Which was mooted, apparently, at one point. Yeah.
Yeah, then it would have... I believe he was offered it, and then he had kind of read between the lines and, you know, everyone's going to think I'm gay if I do this. So I think that certainly would have came through much more so. It would need a different actor, I think.
Yeah, and ultimately we don't know because the film can't answer these questions, even if it tries to ask them in some ways with coding and so on. It
exactly.
Could never come out and clarify things at that time. Like we were kind of saying, I think Rupert's, the kind of trajectory he has here is quite critical, isn't it? It makes the film very powerful, I think, actually. Much more so than if he had just been a detective or if he had just been somebody who put the pieces together. Because, like I say, he realizes how implicated he is, you know. So we get that kind of reckoning, don't we, where that horror he feels, and Stewart's really good at conveying that horror.
Oh, yeah.
But to some extent, that has to be directed in at himself, doesn't it? So we get that kind of, I think you get, it's a really good moment, I think, when he fires the gun out the window. It's kind of a, you know, you get that moral clarity. But it's not triumphalist, is it? Because he seems very deflated. It's not like a a happy ending as such. He has to come to terms now with the fact that his words, which he never thought about the real consequences of them, but they did have real consequences. So that's what fascinates me about him, I think, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he even points out to the fact that he's exhausted, right? And yeah, I mean, one of the most striking images is just that ending of them sitting, you know, Philip is on the piano, Brandon's drinking, and there's Rupert, you know, sitting there exhausted, and he has to come to terms with what he made Brendan think he was saying. But I think that last monologue is great. And I thought Stewart did it so well. I mean, his outrage, he learns that, as he said, everything that, you know, he saw the world as dark and disturbing. And he dealt with that by saying he was intellectually superior, that I'm better than them. You know, obviously this was always a joke that we could just do away with people who are, you know, inferior to us intellectually or stuff like that. And of course, Brendan took that seriously. So, I mean, you can imagine that someone that you have a close relationship with is suddenly a murderer and psychotic. And he's discovering all that in a matter of minutes as he's there, yeah, in a matter of one evening. And I thought Stewart, you know, it's funny because I always thought that he was pushing it in that model, but when I watched it again, he's not at all. I actually thought he did it very beautifully. It's very, really, you know, well done. I mean, you know, you need a really good actor to be able to do that in one take. And of course, he was a theater actor, you know, and I thought he did it so, so well.
It's a really good monologue. I think it's fantastic. Yeah. I think that, so there's the idea, isn't there, with Stewart, that he normally represents, if Cary Grant is kind of a wish fulfillment figure for Hitchcock, it's been said, I think it's in Donald Spoto's biography of Hitchcock, that Stewart is like Hitchcock as he really is. So here we get somebody who's kind of obsessed with murder. In Rear Window, he's the voyeur. You know, in The Man Who Knew Too Much, he's kind of a manipulative husband. And then in Vertigo, he's like the doomed romantic figure.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting to see Rope in that light as kind of the first stepping stone on their kind of screen partnership.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, this was the first thing? This wasn't the first film. It was the first film they did together, wasn't it?
It was.
That's right. Yeah.
Have you seen the trailer for Rope, by the way? It's got quite an unusual trailer. Have you seen it?
I may have in the past, but I can't. It's not fresh in my mind.
Yeah, I don't think I'd seen it before this week, actually. It's the murder victim and Janet, his girlfriend, they're talking kind of hours before the party on a bench. So they talk for a little bit. And then you go to Stuart, who's in character, but he's talking about how it's the last time you'll ever see this man alive or something like that, you know. So it's quite unusual. You get some unusual trailers for Hitchcock's films, but I didn't realize, yeah, like I say, that this was one of them, you know.
I'll have to check that out. I saw it. I saw it on online, but I didn't take a look at it, but I'll have to see that.
Yeah. I just had a few bits of trivia, really. I mean, the play was English, so the screenwriter said that translating it from English into American was actually harder than he expected. He said that when you have phrases like "my dear boy" in English,
right,
they sound kind of different, and then in the American context, they actually made it sound more unintentionally homosexual than they had intended. So he says that after he took all that stuff out, then he went to New York to do something. And then a lot of those phrases from the original play were put back in. He also said that the differences between America and England in terms of the class systems made adapting it harder than he anticipated. But yeah, like you kind of alluded to earlier, I think another interesting thing people might be fascinated to know is that several American social and educational associations condemned Rope as being dangerous, undesirable. Some European cinemas asked for different films to be shipped to them instead, presumably because of the treatment of homosexuality.
Right, right.
It's quite striking, isn't it, to think that it could cause a stir like that, you know?
Yeah, well, that's what I've said. I was surprised. I mean, you know, some people I spoke to online about it said, you know, that it maybe is harder to see now because, you know, back then, even if a man, I mean, this is just from what some people said, but even if a man, let's say, put their hands on someone's shoulder, people would think, hey, what are you doing? Are you, That's, you know, that's not what men, quote unquote, men do. But now we don't, you know, no one would see that way, generally speaking. Yeah. So perhaps back then it or just the fact that two men lived together or they were going to Connecticut together, back then that was sort of very stood out as being very implied. But again, this is just from what I was told. I mean, this is 73 years ago. So certainly that, I guess it did pop out, you know, really to people.
Yeah. And I think they had some fun here with not just that, but in general, putting in a lot of words and phrases in the film that would have a double meaning. So, you know, when Philip is told, like, these hands will bring you great fame, you know, he's staring down at his hands.
Yeah. And he's looking at it in shock, right? You know.
Yeah. Have you heard anything else, Robert, in terms of trivia, or is there anything else about the film you wanted to bring up, or any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I think it's really like I said, I think it's those films that people don't think about with Hitchcock as much as they do with Psycho or The Birds or you know, the bells and whistles what's the other one I'm thinking that's with Cary Grant that is North by Northwest, you know, the On the Run films I really think his more interesting ones are these, you know, one location, more psychological, much less plot driven films, to me are where he shone the most. And this is certainly up there with one of my favorites and one of his best. Yeah, certainly. So yeah, if people haven't seen it, highly recommend it. I think people will really mostly really at least be entertained by it, but it's a lot more than entertaining, I think.
I think so. And it's only 80 minutes as well.
Yeah, it's really short. Yeah.
It is really short. You might have a similar experience to me and like really revise your opinion on it if it's one you've dismissed. I agree with you, Robert, though, about he's got such a strength and depth, isn't he, in his filmography, Hitchcock, that it is sometimes it's the deep cuts that really resonate with you. That's what I find. Like I just bought a box set a while ago of some of his very early films and I'd seen a few of them. I'd seen The Lodger and whatever.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to see Blackmail. So I bought this box set and it had these other early films too. I'd like The Farmer's Wife and Champagne,
yeah,
which I didn't know much about. And there's some really good stuff in there. There's a film called The Ring, which is a love triangle involving a boxer.
Yeah, I saw that as well.
You look at the plot on paper and you think, well, you know, it sounds okay. It's fantastic. You know, it's really, really good.
It's really good. I was fortunate. You probably heard of it, or maybe you did. It was a TCM. I don't know if they're still doing it, but they would have free courses every year. I forget what the university was that they partnered up with, and they did a Hitchcock one 4 years ago. And so, you know, I learned so much of really how diverse his filmmaking was. I mean, he really found a way to touch on, you know, psychological or complex issues within something that was highly entertaining or highly plot driven or horror or suspense and stuff like that. I mean, during the Hays Code, especially, he really was clever in the ways in which he told stories. But yeah, The Ring, I've seen, there are still quite a few I haven't seen actually. But there's always something, even in his lesser films, there's always something that he did that was quite interesting. I know that later in he was saying to Truffaut that perhaps he should have experimented with the form more, you know, because even though he had psychological issues, he never really explored them in detail or in depth. It was because he had these suspense plots. It was the plot really took those things over. But still, I mean, he's a film school. So if you want to be a director, he's certainly someone you need to know, I think.
Yeah, and that's probably a nice point to end on, I think. And I'm sure we'll come back to Hitchcock on the podcast at some point because there are so many more films that, you know, would be fun to discuss.
Absolutely.
But yeah, Robert, so just to conclude then, so yeah, thanks for joining me first of all.
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So do you want to direct people to where you are online and just make sure they've got the name of your YouTube channel and all that kind of thing? What you're up to online?
Yeah, so the YouTube channel is youtube.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies. And I was fortunate, all the social medias, I was able to use the exact same thing. So except it's a little different on Twitter, but Facebook and Instagram, they're all at Robert Bellissimo at the movies. And Twitter is the only one, which is at RB at the movies. So yeah, easy to find. And we go live on the podcast normally Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then I do a regular short video. Now I'm doing that on every weekend, highlighting a certain scene in a movie or looking at a certain performance and stuff like that. But yeah, just Robert Bellissimo at the movies is, even if you Google it, it'll come up.
Great stuff. So listeners, you know what to do. It's over to you now. You can find me on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. You can find the podcast, I'm mainly on Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram. If you search for Movie Palace. But yeah, thanks for joining us, listeners. Hope you enjoyed this discussion about Hitchcock's Rope. That's all for this episode. So I hope you can join me next time, listeners, when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. Pick a disc.
The chorus feels like it's improvised as well.
It's improvised, like... but I also think it's like... respect, because everybody gets a shout out. Busta Rhymes in effect, Shahid is in effect, Five Dog is in effect, and I think towards the end, I know towards the end who's in the house. Ron Carter is in the house. So I kind of think of it, this is going to be very professorial sounding, but if you write a research paper and you know you put all your citations of your sources,
yeah,
it's all the citations. These are all the folks that made this come together.
he's reading the Wikipedia footnotes for this song, isn't he? So,
like 30, exactly.
20 years before it came in effect and stuff.
Make It So, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
To your theory, Gene Roddenberry, one of his golden rules was that conflict always had to be external, right? Like it couldn't be internal. You couldn't have, the main drama being between the two people on the show. It always had to be humanity fighting outward because we were already connected and we had already resolved most of those issues, right? And as Trek has evolved and we've started to incorporate many of the real life drama that can occur between actual people, which I think it's made the show all the better for it.
Yeah.
But I think you're on to something.
Right in the childhood.
The big thing is, Raven has a vision that the job she was going for, she didn't get because the woman says to Raven's vision, I don't hire black people. We cringe.
The fact that it was done with... the actor playing the racist job
Chloe
did it with real venom and the kind of...
She did it throughout everything, though. Like,
it was horrible.
She was not so subtle with how she felt about black people. Chelsea couldn't pick up on it.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Hello everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. just head to patreon.com/wemadethis. That's patreon.com/wemadethis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.